We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovic. Joining me today is Mike from the Parallel Systems YouTube channel. Thanks for joining me today, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great to have you. And, you know, we're going to base today's discussion around kind of this BRICS Plus idea of going to a new reserve currency for the world. So maybe it's best to start by giving us a little bit of a historical context for where we are in these kind of currency cycles, if you could.
Yeah, so what we're living through right now, Tom, is we're coming to the end of a cycle, and it's a very well-established cycle. It goes back to the 15th century, and this is the changing of reserve currencies. Now, we've had six reserve currencies since that time. It was the Portuguese, the Spanish, the Dutch, the French, the British, and of course, now we've got the US dollar as the global reserve. But this cycle is very well established. It lasts on average around 100 years, and the US is probably getting to the end of its own cycle. And that's why we're starting to see lots more conflict and lots more discussion around what the next chapter will be in this monetary system. Now, what's important to note is that towards the end of one system and the start of another is often a period historically of great conflict and turbulence. So if you look back towards when the British, for example, were losing their reserve status, they enacted two world wars, or they were a part of two world wars. There was also the Great Depression, going back to when the British took the reserve currency off France. There was the French Revolution. There was also the Napoleonic Wars. And if you go back, Tom, throughout history, what you find is that these periods all have a similar flavor. It's often conflict at home in the existing empire. So you often have two segments of society becoming increasingly hostile to one another. And of course, we've got that in the US right now, but also in Europe too. You also often have wars, so usually global wars. And of course, we've got the potential for that right now too. So that gives you the historical context, Tom. This is something that if you look back through history, we've been here many times before. Obviously, every single time will have a different flavor. It will take a slightly different path. And technology as well also will change the way it works this time quite vastly also. But in general, what we're seeing is something that we've seen many times before.
And I think, you know, an interesting point as you're talking about the differences this time, or maybe the differences between countries, is talking a little bit about how commodities might play a role in this new system, in this new era of a new reserve currency.
Yeah, so what you often see, Tom, is that as a new currency regime comes into the fold, it often makes amends for the failure of the previous regime. So, of course, in the current dollar-based system, we've got an awful lot of debt, and the dollar is no longer backed by gold. It's a fiat currency, and all of the world's fiat currencies, well, they used to be non-fiat. They was all pegged to the dollar, and the dollar was obviously backed by gold. But since that changed, we've been on this fiat standard, and we can say that the currencies are backed, but they're backed by debt, and we've got an awful lot of debt in the system right now. So the new currency regime will try to fix that. And it will do that, Tom, to try and make itself appealing, because at some point, countries are going to have to try and extricate themselves from the old system. And that can be quite painful, because the US will do all it can to hang on to its power status. At least historically, that's what we've always seen. We've always seen the existing superpower do whatever it can to maintain its grip on global power for obvious reasons. So the new system is proposing that it is going to be based on commodities, which will bring stability to the new monetary system. Now, it's not going to be a monetary system, Tom, that is going to be used in domestic payments. It's going to be something that's used for international payments. And I'm sure we can talk a little bit more about that in the interview, about how it's going to look exactly. But yeah, commodities will certainly be brought back into the fold, as will gold and also the precious metals as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to get to that. But maybe before we do, can you give us a couple examples of how the US has really weaponized the dollar? And, you know, as you put it in your excellent video about this, how the US has really used it as a baseball bat over other countries' heads?
Yeah, so of course, having the reserve currency is a great privilege in itself, because you get to essentially export a lot of your inflation and create this artificial demand for your currency. And that's exactly what the US has done. So purely on that basis alone, it is somewhat of a weapon that the US can exploit. But in terms of its overt weaponization, we've seen the US use the dollar to obviously enact sanctions. We saw them recently block Russia from the SWIFT system. This was a very powerful tool in their arsenal. But historically, they have also frozen reserves of a number of countries. So we saw that happen with Iran, Iraq, Venezuela. To speak about Venezuela a little bit more, they still don't have access to their gold holdings at the Bank of England. I think that's been going to court recently. And just as an aside, I actually met a person who fled Venezuela quite recently in Poland. And he was telling me about just how bad life is there. He was actually walking 5 hours each day to get necessity goods. That's basically all his life revolved around, was going out each day to get water and food. So it's a real collapse moment over there, Tom. And of course, I'm sure those gold holdings would be quite appreciated by the people there right now if it was at least going to bring some respite to the situation. Mm-hmm. So the US is quite happy to weaponize the dollar when it serves their international interests. And of course, they've gone to war numerous times to defend that petrodollar. We know that in the build-up to the Iraq war, Saddam Hussein was actually discussing using euros instead of dollars for payments for the national oil reserves. So a few months later, you know, US went in and he was toppled. So you can see this throughout the past 20 years that whenever somebody has come along with a proposition to move away from the dollar, particularly in the in terms of selling oil, that the US has not long after had some kind of conflict with them. And I think what we're seeing now in Russia is an extension of that. Of course, there's other reasons to what's going on in terms of the invasion of Ukraine. But in terms of actually how they've weaponized the dollar against Russia, this has got to the point now where there's many countries out there, particularly emerging markets, who are saying, moving forward, do we want to be a part of this system? This system that is probably going to implode at some point anyways because of the massive amounts of debt that now weigh it down. And that is a time bomb waiting to explode. That could happen at any point. All it would take is the right domino to fall, and then you'd have this cascading effect where the dollar could essentially collapse anyways. But even if that doesn't happen, Tom, even if that doesn't happen, countries are no longer willing to trust the US as their global hegemon in terms of having access to this reserve currency and control over it. What countries are looking for now is a reserve currency that doesn't have any one sovereign nation controlling that currency. And that's essentially where this idea, I mean, we call it the BRICS or the BRICS Plus because there's a lot of other countries that want to join this now. And there's a great appetite out there. I mean, even Saudi Arabia now, historically an ally of the US, are seeking to join this. But really, we should call it probably the de-dollarization coalition, because that's essentially what it is. That is essentially the main topic of discussion now with BRICS, is about how they create a system that circumnavigates the dollar and potentially in the future will supersede it as the global international reserve currency. Mm-hmm.
And you made a really important point there earlier about the fact that this new currency has to be, you know, attractive enough to any of these other countries to be able to trade in over the dollar, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's going to be much more costly in the short run for countries to go into this system that, you know, it doesn't even have the right infrastructure in place yet. So it's not that appealing to just jump ship from the dollar right now and, you know, remove it from your reserves. But over time, I think over time, Tom, we're going to see more and more countries be willing to make that leap. But of course, there will be a reaction to you from the US. You know, Janet Yellen said just the other week that they will protect the dollar. And it was almost, it felt like a bit like a Mario Draghi moment. We'll do whatever it takes. You know, it was quite, I can't remember exactly how she framed it, but it was pretty strong words about protecting the dollar and its status as global reserve. So this is why we all should be expecting increased conflict, because there is no way that the US is going to let go of the dollar and its privilege that comes with the dollar without a fight. And I think we've seen that historically over the past two decades, and we're seeing that right now play out. Unfolding in real time in what's happening in Russia.
So maybe to dig a little bit down further into this story, maybe if you can explain to us who the BRICS nations or BRICS plus nations are, and maybe why their demographics play such a big role in their success going forward as well.
Yeah, so the BRICS stand for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It was originally just the first five, and then South Africa joined a little bit later. And they've been a coalition since, I think it's 2009 was when they first decided to make this coalition. And most of their discussions are around economic ties. So it's not about ceding sovereignty for any country. It's about coming together, recognizing that they control a significant proportion of the world's economy. So they've got, I think it's 40% of the world's population, 30% of the world's GDP across these nations, and 20% of world trade. So it's a significant power base there. And they realize that there's similarities across their demographics too. Not in terms of the age of the population, but in terms of emerging markets, increase in standards of living, rapid growth phase. So all of these things lend themselves as emerging markets to coming together to try and create economic bonds, basically. And one of the key problems that the BRICS have is many of them are heavily indebted in dollars and also heavily dependent on the dollar in terms of a lot of dollar funding. So this is why when we've got a strong dollar like we do now, it leads to all kinds of problems and sometimes even collapse in emerging markets. So they've all got a vested interest to move away from the dollar. Now, for Russia and China, it's actually existential because China as the, I'm not going to say hegemon because I don't think China even sees itself as the next hegemon, but certainly a global superpower that will at some point in their eyes equal the US. They have no interest in taking on the dollar as its reserve currency, because of course that makes no sense. If you're a rising superpower and you're coming into conflict with the existing superpower, you need to have independence in terms of the reserve currency. Now for Russia, of course, with the sanctions, they actually have no choice at this stage. And that is why they've had to enact what really is the first stage of countries moving away from the dollar as a reserve currency. And that's transacting again in national currencies and also accepting gold as well as payment, which Russia has said they're quite happy to do. So really that's step one, Tom. And I think in the coming years, you're going to see more and more countries creating bilateral swaps for currencies and accepting one another's currencies for trading commodities. And that's essentially what the stage we're at now. But there's a few more stages to go before we get to the actual BRICS currency. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, BRICS currency, as they call it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe this is a good point to kind of dig into who Sergey Glazyev is. And a lot of this material kind of comes from what he's been talking about. Is that right?
Yeah, Sergey Glazyev is a Russian economist, and he was an advisor to Vladimir Putin for many years. He's also a bit of a geopolitical strategist. Now, he was actually one of the first individuals that America actually sanctioned in the first round of sanctions in 2014. And that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, he wasn't an oligarch. He wasn't a politician. He wasn't a military general. He was an economist. But he is a key architect of this new monetary system. So I think that probably is quite telling. There's other reasons as well, but it was an interesting choice as one of the first people that they sanctioned. And a lot of the things that we're seeing right now are ideas that he has been espousing for a number of years, going back at least 10 years. But also, Tom, it's not just people like him. I mean, back in 2019, the governor of the People's Bank of China released a white paper. I can't remember its title. It was Reforming the International Monetary System, I think. And this was all about, again, moving away from the dollar. And in that paper, they actually discussed going to the SDR, using the IMF's SDR, allowing more countries to use the SDR to have their currencies in the basket and then weighting it on things like GDP, population size, share of world trade, and then also adding commodities to it to make it more stable. Now, this is essentially the system that the BRICS nation are designing right now. It's the same thing. So there was a point in the past where it seemed like there was a request from the BRICS nations, at least China and Russia, to create this system in cooperation with the West, with the US. And for whatever reason, that never happened. So they took it into their own hands. And like I said, Sergey Glazyev was a key architect of that system. And some of his material on that is really eye-opening. It really gives you a much more thorough understanding of how this currency is going to look. And I think that's one thing that people in the West have missed, is maybe having somebody that's actually at the forefront, somebody that's speaking and working on this currency, come out and share that information. And there's reasons for that. I think he's actually banned in the West. I don't think you can get his books here. So that's one of the reasons.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we think about the amount of debt in the world, how does that play a role in this transition to a new system as well?
Well, I mean, as it stands right now, I think the US debt to GDP is around 137%. But you know, when you really look into the fiscal state of the United States, they've got unfunded liabilities now around 130 plus trillion, is it? So, you know, there's an awful lot of debt in the system. And essentially in the West, we've got economies that are now built on debt, you know, household debt and corporate debt. They're both sky high. And of course, there's no way to ever repay that debt, Tom. So what has to happen at some point is it has to be dealt with. And historically, it's nearly always been dealt with a hyperinflationary event. If not very high inflation, but it's usually hyperinflationary. And I guess for these other countries, it makes sense to go through some short-term pain to try and extricate themselves from this global debt bomb that is at some point going to have to explode now, and take that short-term pain now in the hope that when that happens, they've already got a functional system that is at least, even if it's in the embryonic stage where they're trading in each other's national currency. And I mean, if the whole system does collapse, Tom, if it does, if there's this massive collapse moment, then I guess nobody will be, no country will be spared at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be that cataclysmic. But there will be something on the other side of that. There always is. And for countries that have already started to put in the key steps to create something else, they will then comparatively at least be far, far further along. And it may be that at that point, there is a global reordering of the current power structures. So the US doesn't come out of that debt collapse, if it does happen, or hyperinflationary event, in the same position as a hegemon as it is today. Mm-hmm.
And you had mentioned in your video that the debts of the, you know, countries that are looking at going into this new system would possibly be ignored in the old system in favor of just starting anew in the new currency system, right?
Yeah, so it's important to understand that there is a strong element of economic warfare coming from both sides. So from the US and also from the BRICS nations, at least in terms of the architecture of the new system. Now, one of the things that Sergei Glazyev discusses in one of his written pieces is that they're going to be creating new ratings agencies. And therefore, when countries join the new system, this new BRICS currency, they are not going to be downgraded. This is going to be built into the system, but their currency will still be as strong as it would otherwise if they default on the debts that are owed to the US in dollars or in euros or pounds or yen. If they default on those debts, Tom, of which there are many trillions of them, then they will not be punished in the new system. Mm-hmm. So implicitly, what they're saying is you can do this. Now, of course, there would be ramifications for that. But if there was a collective default, if there was a number of nations in the global South and in Latin Americas that decided to default simultaneously, at that point, what would happen? What would the US be able to fight wars on all of those fronts? Probably not. So there is the potential there for this new monetary system as it emerges to draw people in and then give them the opportunity to actually just say, we're not paying it. You know, we're defaulting on that. Because at that point, Tom, they've got access to this new system. They would have no need for those currencies and no need to have the rating in terms of, you know, their credit worthiness to the old system, because this new system has already sprung up, particularly if that old system is going to collapse anyways. You know, it may be that they see it as, what is the point? You know, what is the point in us doing that? Why be beholden and anchored down by all of this debt? Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how is the condition of all of these central banks buying gold that we've seen over the last couple of years? Is that maybe a symptom of them sensing that there is a need for a change and them needing to have reserves in order to move to some kind of new system, or at least protect themselves with having gold on their balance sheets?
I think it's very interesting, Tom, because you had the central Bank of the Czech Republic this year announced that they're going to increase their gold holdings by 10x. And I know that Poland has achieved a similar increase in recent years. And I was listening to an interview with the governor of the Polish Central Bank. And what he said was really interesting. He said that the reason why Poland are increasing their holdings so much is because they want to be prepared for all scenarios, including a global monetary collapse or a situation where the existing financial system essentially freezes up. Now, that sounds quite conspiratorial, particularly for somebody who's the head of a central bank to say publicly, but that's exactly what he said. So what that says to me is that the banks are well aware that we're reaching some kind of critical juncture in the current system. And that one way or another, this is going to have to resolve itself in the coming years. Now, that could be one of many ways, but it will probably not be good. I don't think we're going to see that orderly transition from one system to another. So I think this significant increase in central bank gold buying that we're seeing across Europe, you know, Poland, Czech Republic, Hungary, Turkey, many other countries, it is essentially preparing for what comes next. Mm-hmm. Now, remember, once this new system is up and running, which is going to be a basket of commodities, that's going to include precious metals too. So it's going to be agricultural commodities, it's going to be natural resources, energy, and obviously precious metals. This is really going to lend itself, Tom, to the countries of the global south and the Latin Americas who have a lot of these resources already. Now, if they can default on their debts to the old system, they could also nationalize their mines then, use that those commodities from these from the mines that they have essentially taken back and back their currencies with that. Now, when you think about it, over time, gold is going to rise up through that basket of commodities because it makes no sense in the long run to back your currency by something that is expendable, such as copper, for example. If Chile back their currency with copper, for example, that's what they're going to use to back their portion of this new global reserve. What happens if there's a copper shortage one year? What happens if they need to use that copper? What happens if there's a global shortage? All of a sudden, they're going to have to use something that they're using to back their currency out in the open market, and that's going to weaken their currency. Again, imagine if you use some agricultural commodities, Tom, and there was a global famine. At that point, you would have to dip into those supplies. And this is why gold makes perfect sense as a reserve asset. That is why it was used for 5,000 years, because it has no other use. You know, it's human energy trapped in gold form. Once you have mined that, and it takes an awful lot of effort to get that, then you can hold it on a balance sheet and you don't have to use it. It's only really used in jewelry, which is essentially just storing wealth anyways. So it's got the perfect function. So I think over time, what we'll probably see is that these countries start to trade their national commodities and buy gold with that also and use that to back their portion of the currency, therefore making sure that it's safe, that the currency is backed and they don't have to weaken it by in the future potentially using these more expendable commodities.
Does gold really help to stabilize these exchange rates between currencies that, you know, traditionally don't really get exchanged that much on a, let's say, a national level?
I think in the new system, Tom, it's going to look very different to how we visualize it today. So right now we've got our floating currencies. And in terms of central banks at present buying gold, there is this psychological detachment from what gold is in the West, because we haven't used it in the monetary system since 1971. So for that reason, I think we see gold almost as a bit of a dead asset in the West. And of course, there's the paper markets too that ensure that the price of gold doesn't really reflect its utility in the monetary system. But once this new monetary system is up and running, this new reserve currency that is being used by the BRICS nation, I think all of a sudden, gold will be seen rightfully, as it has been seen for thousands of years throughout history, as a vital part of backing a currency. You know, it's going to be something that is fundamental to that system. But I think what we'll also see is in the transition to the new system, gold will become increasingly important, not just in the nations of the BRICS or the BRICS Plus, but also in the West as well. And the reason I think that, Tom, is because at some point, they're going to have to stop trading commodities in dollar denomination. So they're going to have to no longer use the dollar as the metric in which they value commodities. They're going to have to go off that system at some point. And then you've got this kind of Wild West where you've just got all these exchange rates that they're going to have to deal with. It'll be a very complex and probably expensive system to maintain. So at that point, it's much more likely, in my opinion, that they would go back to pricing commodities purely in gold, something more stable. And I think at that point in the West, the way people see gold would shift very significantly. The psychological impact of that, to see all of these nations using gold as a pricing mechanism for commodities, would immediately signal to people in the West that gold is going to be revalued at some point. Now, also, Tom, you've got to think that if there is this bifurcation between the two systems, so let's imagine that these BRICS nations do manage to achieve what they set, their stated aims, and create this system that is circumnavigating the petrodollar, then all of a sudden, all of these countries in the West that have to, by default, remain part of the American system, the US is not going to allow European countries to take part in this, you know, and we'll probably see in the coming years just how far the US is willing to go to try and stop other countries from taking part in this. Because right now we've got Turkey saying they want to join the de-dollarization coalition, as I call it. So, and remember, Turkey is a NATO member. So we'll see what the implications of that are. But once that system is up and running, what are the countries of Europe going to be able to offer in terms of putting up something of value to trade with these countries? That, remember, all of these countries are where all of the global commodities lie. Now, for thousands of years, the global superpowers in the West have been going into these countries, extracting those commodities and taking them back home. But if these countries are now forcing their sovereignty much more firmly and saying, we are a part of a new system, they are only going to accept something of value in exchange for those commodities. And at that point, I think the countries of Europe are going to have to put up gold. They're going to have no use no more for dollar, yen, or whatever substitute they create in a new system, unless they come together to create one system, which could happen. But if not, then all of a sudden, I think you see gold being used by central banks to trade in commodities globally. And there's a strong chance that that happens if we do see that bifurcation between the two systems. Mm-hmm.
So when you mentioned the revaluation of gold, what do you think that we need to see to have that happen? Do you think, you know, China declaring their official gold reserves, is that the catalyst for it? Or how do you see that process kind of playing out of gold really being revalued?
I think for gold to be revalued in the West, there has to be a psychological shift in the way people understand gold. It could happen by default if there's some kind of catastrophic collapse moment in the current system and they have to go back to some kind of hard-backed currency. That's a potential. It could happen if the paper markets blow up and all of a sudden we see this rapid increase in the price, so people all of a sudden become aware of it again. But I think ultimately, Tom, it's down to psychology. It's the idea that gold is a pet rock, as Warren Buffett once called it. You know, this idea that it's got no intrinsic use anymore. I think once people see in the East, and we're seeing that right now, right? We saw Russia say that the central bank will buy gold at a fixed price. And people have all of a sudden become aware of just how powerful commodities are and gold when it comes to backing your currency, that the Russian ruble all of a sudden came from drop it. I can't remember how much it dropped by, but it became one of the strongest performing currencies of the last year. So I think that is starting to shift people's perception on gold. So I think it's more going to be how the public perceive it, Tom. If people start to buy gold, if people start to treat gold as something that is a store of wealth for themselves, then I think the whole system will collapse fairly quickly. In terms of the US, how long they can drag this system out for using the paper markets and manipulating the price. At the point the East have a system up and running where they're actually using gold to transact, that would all fall apart very quickly. And I think immediately you'd see gold revalue 10x, 12x, 50x, who knows? You know, we don't actually know how high could gold could go when it becomes such an intrinsic part of a new monetary regime. Mm-hmm.
So is it possible, though, that we see, you know, one country try to dominate this new system? Or is the point of it so that everybody is kind of equal and has the ability to trade freely with the others?
Yeah, well, I don't think China has any real appetite to become the dominating country in this new system. Because if you look back through what the People's Bank of China have said about creating a new system, it was always about creating something that was more egalitarian, that would allow countries to not be beholden to any one sovereign nation by having their currency as the global reserve, such as we've had with the US dollar. So I don't think that's the aim. The aim truly is to create a more cooperative system. And that is how it's been pitched to countries. And that is why countries are essentially wanting to jump into this, Tom, because it will play to their strength. They're, you know, if you're a commodity producing nation, then of course this is the new currency that you want to be in. Now, if it was purely gold, then China could quite easily dominate that system because, as we know, their real gold holdings were probably over 10,000 tons now. So if that was just the case, then they would just do a gold-backed system. But because they're expanding it to a list, I think at present it's around 21 commodities, you know, that's going to open up the currency. I mean, if you are in Chile, you can back it with copper. If you're in Argentina, it might be agricultural commodities. You know, Russia, it could be oil or gas or gold. It's really up to you what you back it with. Although I do think the more you play that out over the next, you know, once this currency was up and running, if you played it out over 20, 30 years, I think, like I said, gold would rise to the top of the currency basket. And that would then lend itself to China, which at that point, I think China would probably be in a position, if she wanted to be a global hegemon.
So what other precious metals might become a part of this basket?
Sure, they're talking about all precious metals. So it would be silver, it would be platinum, industrial metals. The basket is completely open by the sounds of it. So again, you know, you've got the potential there for a massive reevaluation of those metals. And I think silver would be a key one to look at as well because of its use in industry going forward too. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we think about, let's say, these debts not being honored to the old system and this entire transition away from the US dollar, won't this trigger, you know, World War III or some major conflicts within the world?
Yeah, well, like I said, Tom, if you look back at the historical cycle, that is exactly what's happened throughout the regime changes in terms of the global economic order. It's always led to some kind of global conflict. Now, it doesn't have to be like that this time. And like I said, some of the reasons for that are technological in nature. But I do say that really essentially, Tom, we are already in World War III. Now, why do I say that? Well, what we're seeing is conflict globally, and we're seeing this bifurcation of East and West. So World War III is probably not going to look like World War II and World War I, where we have millions and millions of men going to fight, usually in the center of Europe. What we're probably going to see this time, Tom, is cyber warfare, biological warfare, economic warfare, and physical conflict through many different wars, probably proxy wars. Now, we've got elements of all those things right now. If you look at the biological warfare element, then what happened from 2020 onwards, which I know you probably can't get into too much on a YouTube video, but that was really the start of some kind of biological conflict. Now, there's many different ideas as to how that came about and who was responsible for that. But essentially, it was a biological attack. And that will continue in the coming years. We will see more of these. And in terms of the economic warfare, well, we've discussed that at length. You know, what Russia had done in terms of the sanctions was meant to be something that would obliterate Russia's economy. Now, of course, they fired economic weapons back, and they've managed so far to survive that. They're going to take a big hit to their growth in the coming years. But for all intents and purposes, Russia managed to come out of it fairly well. And I think, if anything, Tom, they managed to do proof of concept for this new currency. They showed that if you back your currency with hard assets, you can strengthen it significantly. Mm-hmm. In terms of the cyber warfare, that's been going on a lot of years. We know that. And two of the biggest targets have been the UK and the US, US number one, UK number two. Now, of course, those are the two real centers of intelligence in the West. So it makes sense that this is a key part of World War III too. And most of that goes over people's heads. You know, we don't know when our governments have had a significant or serious cyber attack. We don't really read about it in the newspaper. But if you do the research on it, that's been escalating in the coming years too. And like I said, now we've got this proxy war with NATO and Russia, and it's spilling out into Europe. And there's future conflicts too, such as China and Taiwan. So really, those are all the elements of World War III, Tom, and they're all taking place right now. I don't think anyone out there would argue that the last few years have been anything but chaotic. And I think in the coming years, we're going to see all of those four elements increase. And this is why I say that really, it's best framed as we are in World War III, and we are in that transition period. However, it doesn't have to necessarily end like it did in the previous world wars.
So, you know, Mike, are all these protests and conflicts that we're seeing associated to cycles in another way?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, Tom, because going into the early 1900s, the British Empire had this period called the Great Upheavals, and this was between 1910 and 1914. And what this was, Tom, was the working classes rising up against their capitalist paymasters, because inequality had got so bad in Great Britain that even if he was working, and it was usually on average 70, 80 hours a week, you know, even if he was working, you were still not able to provide for your family. And of course, we've got great inequality now, probably not at those levels, but comparatively speaking, we do have equality around those levels. And what this led to was massive, massive uprisings in the UK. I think in 1913 alone, there was 40 million work hours lost. And at one point, the UK government sent gunboats down the Mersey to threaten the dock strikers. So, you know, this was a huge societal conflict, and really it was class warfare. And it certainly had the potential to become something similar to the French Revolution. But what happened was World War One occurred in 1914, and essentially all those people got blacklisted. They couldn't work. They all inscripted into the army, and they all went out to die in Europe. And that ended that period of social conflict. But if we go back 100 years previously to when the reserve currency was changing, we had the French Revolution, which was about as bloody as it gets. And again, it was this societal conflict where you had two groups fighting over who was going to be dominant in society, who was going to lead the way ideologically. And again, these kind of periods that we're in right now, Tom, are extremely dangerous. Now, of course, in the past few years in the US, Canada, Europe, we've seen similar things occurring, mostly in the US, but it definitely leaks out across the empire. If you imagine the US empire, it really what happens there starts to have shockwaves across all of it. So we had the Black Lives Matter riots in 2020. And I think a lot of what we're seeing today as well, Tom, is just this atomization of society. And I think that really serves the interests of the existing elites in society, because, of course, they know that the system that they have been beholden to for many years is coming to an end. And they want to make sure that they come out on top, even if there is going to be a reordering of the global powers, that they still have a significant amount of control and influence in the new system. Now, if you've got a lot of people arguing it, and if we take the lessons from history, what often happens is people unite against the upper classes, against the elites, as they see it. And, you know, in 2008, we had this Occupy Wall Street, which, however misguided it was, it should have been Occupy the Fed. But whatever, at least it was in the right ballpark, you know, at least it was getting closer to it. And like I said, this happened in the 1900s as well in Great Britain. So the elites are acutely aware that these periods of history could lead to some serious societal shifts as well. So it is in their interest to try and redirect the anger that society has from growing inequality, you know, young people not realizing the source of inequality in society. And then these ideologies come along and say, well, it's because of X, Y, and Z. And then it redirects all the anger back onto society rather than the actual culprits of the societal inequality, which, as we know, is central banking. And of course, now it's a corrupt elite system as well. You know, politicians in the US, they're the best stock traders going. So, you know, it gives you an insight into just how rotten the system has become. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we think about all of these protests and conflicts, you know, Sri Lanka comes to mind, the Netherlands come to mind with the major protests. But, you know, we're even seeing some Western leaders, you know, Boris Johnson, for example, or Mario Draghi stepping down. Do you think that that's part of a bigger theme, or what is the way that you're looking at those situations?
Well, I think in the West, at least, we've seen this capture of sovereign nations and politics. I mean, we saw that video of Klaus Schwab saying that he penetrates the cabinets, and I know he's penetrated the Canadian cabinet with your Trudeau over there. So we do have this idea that there is some oligarchical class that has decided that they have the solutions for the future. And however dystopian and, you know, egregious we see that, we don't want to be a part of it. Our politicians are essentially now apparently being handpicked by them, or at least thrust into positions of power, given all the support, all the resources to get into power. So when it comes to this revolving door of politicians, you have to probably frame it in that way, that for whatever reason, those politicians have been expended in terms of their usefulness, and now they're going to put someone else in who's going to advance the agenda further. But I certainly wouldn't expect to see anybody come into a position of power, not at least not in the in America, Canada, the UK, Australia, or New Zealand. I think in those countries particularly, maybe in Europe, however, what we're going to see in Europe is going to be quite different. I think you're probably going to see a big shift back to populism. We're already seeing that in Italy. Where I live in Poland, it's quite a populist government that's in power right now, and they're very popular amongst the people. So I think in Europe particularly, especially after we go through these energy crises and, you know, potential food shortages coming next year, people are not going to be behind these green agendas and these more utopian-esque ideas when they're seeing it impoverish their own people back at home. And of course, we saw this in the 1930s, the rise of populism, and that can lead to all kinds of chaotic futures as well. So, yeah, I think there's real risk out there, Tom, but I certainly wouldn't expect anyone in those countries mentioned to be offering anything new that we haven't heard already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. So, you know, considering all of this chaos and everything, Mike, how do we, you know, from your perspective, protect ourselves?
Well, I think first and foremost, Tom, it's important for people to realize that moving forward, it's much more unlikely that they're going to be able to depend on the existing structures that they have previously to provide for themselves and their families. And we saw this throughout 2020. Whatever view you take on that, there was many people who couldn't get access to basic healthcare, for example. I know in the UK, most of my family, they couldn't get an appointment. And if they tried to, even elderly family relatives, it was months in advance. So you've got to start thinking about how you protect yourself from some of the more serious consequences. Now, in Europe right now, we've got the potential for a winter with heat rationing. You know, just this week, the EU announced that European nations are going to have to reduce their gas use by 15% by next year. So these are serious consequences, and these are going to lead to significant amounts of excess deaths come winter. So again, you know, it's about first and foremost, before you're worrying about your investments, start to worry about making sure you've just got enough in terms of food, energy security, water. You know, if you know where we live, it's kind of like a homesteading community, so we all have wells. But those things in the past, people probably would have scoffed at. You know, they wouldn't have thought that we would ever live in a future where those things are at risk. But right now, that's exactly what's happening. Now, I know you had Doomberg on a month or so ago, and he talked about the potential for food shortages too. And I think going into next year again, you know, maybe you could start preparing for those things now. You know, just doesn't have to be anything extreme, but it's just having that nod to the future to make sure that if the worst does happen, you and your family are protected in that manner. Now, beyond that, of course, we need to think about how we protect ourselves financially. And that's really important because there's so many risks right now, Tom. We've got high inflation across the Western and developed world. So, you know, that puts you in a very difficult spot. If you've got savings in the bank and you're losing 15% a year, that means you've got to make 16% just to have a 1% increase or 15% to break even. That's a very, very difficult thing to achieve year on year. Mm-hmm. So you've got to think about maybe extending your thought beyond the current system. And this is one of the reasons why I think this topic's important, to not think about how you survive this system, but what's going to be important in the next system. It may be that right, what we do right now is just be very defensive, you know. And I'm a big investor in the miners, and I think the mining space is the best place to be right now. There's some great opportunities. But I also think be slightly more defensive than you normally would, because what's coming could change very quickly. And with the risks right now in the global financial system, we've got many, many emerging markets that are seemingly going to default. And any one of these things, Tom, could be that domino that sets up a cascading effect where you've got this freeze up of the financial system and you have to go back to being quite self-reliant. And I think at that point, you'd probably be quite happy that you was a little bit more defensive than aggressive during this period of history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. So, you know, as we're kind of wrapping up here, is there anything else that you think that is worth mentioning to kind of open people's eyes or make them think about? You know, what came to mind when we were talking about nationalization? And on the other hand, you're saying that you like miners. Isn't that a huge risk for owning some of these miners?
Yeah, well, I think mining is always risky for sure. But I think going forward, as you look out on your timeline horizon, I think the short term, there is not any immediate risk that this new system is going to come into being. You know, they've got a lot of structures they have to put into place. And I think if you want some strikers on the field, you know, you want to be quite defensive, you still want a couple of strikers on the field, that could be a much smaller portion of your portfolio than it was, say, 5 years ago or even 2 years ago. And I think the miners offer the best opportunity because, like I said, there is this decay for any money that you're leaving sat in cash. Or do you really want to have all of your money in bullion or property? You know, there's risks everywhere, Tom. That's the problem. There is risks everywhere. And you have to act. Like if you go back to the 1970s stagflation, there wasn't a lot of safe havens there outside of metals, miners. And that was pretty much it. Everything else saw significant real declines. Nominally, a lot of things went up in the 1970s. But in real terms, many things went down. The pound devalued by around 70% during that decade. So for people sat in cash towards the end of that decade, you know, their savings were buying them 70% less. And I think this is the real risk for us all right now. It's about how do we build a defensive portfolio but still have some strikers on the field. Now, looking at the equities in general, you know, do you want to be in tech stocks right now? You know, there's so many risks out there, but we've got miners right now. Tom, that are trading at, well, if you look at the disconnect between gold and the miners right now, it's pretty shocking. You know, I was looking at some prices of some of the miners just recently, and they're trading at prices that they hadn't seen since gold was around $1,200. And there was 40% less dollars in existence at that point too. So there's some real bargains out there. Now, of course, there's always risk if there is a broader equity decline, some kind of collapse like we saw in 2020, then nothing's going to escape that. But if you're buying in miners at lows that have been hit only a few times in their trading histories, particularly the junior miners I'm thinking of, you've got to think, Tom, there is an awful lot of upside there, particularly in the coming year or so. And the chances are that even if we do have a broader equity decline, you're probably not going to lose on that trade in the coming 2 to 5 years. You know, it will recover fairly quickly, just like we saw after 2008. And I think you'll probably be quite happy that you own those miners and had some money out there. Now, what that is for each individual, how much you actually want to be risking right now, that I guess depends on how pessimistic you are with the global outlook. For me, it's much less than it would have been a year ago, Tom, much less than it would have been a year ago. I'm talking less than 50%. Mm-hmm.
So do you actually have some kind of a timeline for when this new currency system or maybe gold's revaluation might come into being here?
Well, it's very hard to predict, Tom. It's also, in many ways, it's about what happens first. Does the current system that we have reach some kind of collapse moment where there's some systemic banking crisis or some debt default that cascades across the world? Does that happen first? Or is there some kind of long period like the 1970s where we just have high inflation and they manage to maintain the system at the expense of the people, of course? I mean, people are going to be getting destroyed over the next few years, even if things stayed the same in terms of inflation. And I don't think inflation is going to go away, Tom. I think it's going to come down. I sold everything back in, I think it was around April, May time. I sold everything because I thought we'd reached the peak of this current wave of inflation. I expected it to come down. And that's exactly what happened. I was very lucky because I'm not usually that good at timing, but at that point, it was the right move. And I think you need to be quite nimble. So you need to be willing to move in and out of positions right now, because that's what we're going to see. We're going to see waves of inflation and then periods of disinflation like we're seeing right now. I think at some point, the Fed will revert course, however. And I think at that point, you need to be in miners. You need to be in gold and probably Bitcoin too. I mean, it's not something that I've ever owned in the past, but I do think there is a good case to have some, because it's limited in supply. And also, Tom, it's got that potential to be used. Should there be some kind of systemic collapse, it's an already functioning network that's out there that you could use to transact or move money. Now, like I said, does that happen first, or do we have this transition over the next decade? At which point, I would say by 2030, I would expect this new system to at least be functional. And we'll have a good idea about at that point of who's going to be a part of it. And probably more importantly for us in the West, who's not. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you do a little bit of technical analysis on your channel as well. Do you think that this is, you know, maybe one of the last, you know, great buying opportunities for gold here around this, you know, $1,700, $1,680 level?
Yeah, I think this is the flaw personally, Tom. Of course, like I said, we're living crazy times. You know, mm-hmm. I think I said to you before the show that if I'd have given you a list of the things that have happened globally over the past few years and asked you where gold would be at the end of all that, I think we'd both agree that we'd have expected it to be much higher than it actually is. But there's reasons for that. And like I said, I think we're in the right space, but in maybe the wrong part of history. I think if you fast forwarded 10, 15 years, you'd be very glad that you'd be very glad that you was in this space. So yeah, that's certainly as I see it in terms of the miners. I don't think you're going to see levels like this again, unless there is an out and out collapse of the markets. And if that's the case, Tom, then, you know, you'll probably have bigger things to worry about than your portfolio of miners. Because I think if we go back to that place, the Fed has one bullet left, and it's a bullet it's going to use on itself. And at that point, we get into that hyperinflationary scenario. If they go and throw more money at this point, I think inflation at that point spirals. And I think the system, then you've got a few years left of it before it all comes collapsing down. So let's take the more optimistic scenario that we've got longer than that. And in that case, you want to have some miners. And right now is a fantastic opportunity. Like I said, the last time we saw these prices, gold was far, far lower in price. You know, gold was around 1200 when we had prices of miners this cheap. So it's definitely a great buying opportunity. Like I said, you know, even Newmont right now, Newmont's giving what, a 4% dividend? You know, it's these are great opportunities out there. You know, 4% dividend is not going to protect you from inflation, but to hold one of the biggest gold miners in the world, you know, I'd take that any day.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to your point about if we were thinking about the value of gold after we listed off all of the current conflicts or world events, I think maybe we just need to step back a little bit and consider timeline a little bit more. And, you know, I think over time, gold will reflect the turbulence in the world.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's so many reasons for that. And, you know, it may sound quite doom and gloom to talk about these things, but I guess taking that step back and looking at things over a broader historical period, things do get better, Tom. After that transition period, you know, it's very turbulent, but after that, we often enter a period where there's some kind of agreement on the new social order, and there's some kind of harmony within society, and we've got these shared aims again. And of course, in that period, if gold comes back to the fold, like we've discussed in today's interview, then it will reward that patience that you've had. But first and foremost, you know, think about those key things just to see you through this period that might last another 5 years or so. And then, you know, if you're in the right space, I think you will be rewarded going forwards. Mm-hmm.
Well, Mike, I think that's a pretty good place to wrap up today's conversation. Of course, your YouTube channel is excellent, Parallel Systems, and you're on Twitter as Parallel_Mike as well. We'll have those links in the show notes. Mike, thanks so much for your time and your knowledge today.
Thanks so much, Tom. I appreciate the time.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.